that intolerable inequality has risen up since the end of Bretton Woods in the 1970s. I think it's a well-established fact that the differences between the left and the right have been whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. But we've always known nobody in their right mind would contest that. The point that Piketty is making, it's a very good point, that this inexorable triumph march of inequality is destabilizing liberal democracies. It's a good point, but again, it's not something we haven't known. What I find, I shall close my talk with more comments on why I think this book has been so successful. I'll just hint at some right at the outset before I get into the main body of my presentation. Within the economics profession, the trickle-down fantasy was always very powerful. And let's not just blame the neoliberals about this. It is true that Adam Smith himself, I shall quote Adam Smith, was a trickle-down fanatic. The rich divide with the poor the produce of all their improvements. They are led by an invisible hand to make nearly the same distribution of the necessaries of life which would have been made had the earth been divided into equal proportions among all its inhabitants, and thus, without intending it, without knowing it, advance the interests of the society and afford means to the multiplication of the species. That's from The Theory of Moral Sentiments, Part 4, Chapter 1. There can be no more powerful statement of trickle-down idiocy than Adam Smith. Now, it is clear that Piketty is opposing this, and that is such a good thing. And one of the reasons why dissidents like us have been incredibly generous in receiving Piketty is because at long last somebody is confronting the trickle-down idiocy. He's also making other very important points, like, for instance, that the best predictor of success is the success of one's parents, and not just in the United States of America. But if you really want to comprehend the Piketty phenomenon, you have to look at it from also the perspective of the way in which not only did those of us who have been dissidents during the trickle-down domination, the domination of that narrative, but there was another crowd that was exceptionally generous to Piketty. They came from, there weren't that many, but they're very influential people. They come from saltwater American economics departments, from MIT, and from Harvard, and from Yale. It includes Paul Krugman, Joe Stiglitz, who have been waxing lyrical about Piketty's book. So you have this combination of dissidents like us, of established figures of the liberal economics department tradition, as well as the kind of aura that has been left behind by the Occupy movement and the 1%. And the emphasis, the correct emphasis and the welcome emphasis on the hideous degrees of inequality that we've been experiencing before the crisis and after the crisis of 2008. And yet, in an article which I wrote recently, I have been claiming that Thomas Piketty's book is a major disservice to egalitarianism. Why on earth would I say that? Is it just sour grapes because I didn't write a book and I didn't collect the royalty fees? It has been said that those of us who have opposed it from the left are just sour grapes people. Let me try to convince you that this is not the reason. The reason is a genuine concern that Mr. Piketty and this emphasis on inequality, this particular kind of emphasis on inequality, is blowing awful reprehensible winds into the sails of inegalitarianism, not of egalitarianism. Which is a nice little contradiction, but as dialecticians, we are not unused to the concept, are we? Now, when we teach economic students, about capital, right? The first thing we need to do, if we are to do our job properly, is to deprogram them, to stop them from thinking that money is capital. We try to introduce them, especially if we are of a Marxist disposition, that capital are goods that have a capacity to produce other goods. Commodities that can produce other commodities. Produced means of production. And we also, if we're given a chance, we take this a little bit further, saying that these goods per se, the machines, the tractors, the seeds, are not enough to create a capital-labor relationship, because capital cannot be seen in opposition, it cannot be seen independently of labor. That capital, as Marx says, is a social relation. So when that gentleman whose name I forgot, this is described in volume one of Capital, ends up, the Englishman who takes a couple of two or three boats to Australia together, and he includes Mr. Not Mr. Piketty. Anyway, it will come to me at some point. Mr. Peel, that's correct. Mr. Peel transports to Australia, to Western Australia for that matter, about 200 workers, equipment, seeds, and so on and so forth, and tries to establish a colony that was going to be run like a capitalist enterprise. After a while, the project fails because these workers simply move out, occupy land that was unoccupied, and set up business for themselves. So the machines, the seeds, the plows are not enough in order to have a capital-labor relationship, in order to talk about capital in a way that is pertinent to capitalism. So we need, this is a hard and dispiriting part of our job, to deprogram students, to try to say to them, look, what you've taken for granted, you shouldn't take it for granted, and you should separate wealth, commodities, from capital. They're not the same thing. Mr. Piketty doesn't do this in his book. He doesn't want to do it. He chooses not to do it. He conflates wealth with capital. And I shall explain why I think he's doing this. Now, what is the problem with this? Why do we need to deprogram students and introduce this differentiation between capital and the rest, wealth? Let me give you an example from my own country's experience. In 2010, when Greece imploded, rich Greeks fled the country and went to places like London. They transferred their wealth to HSBC or Barclays Bank or Lloyds Bank, and very soon after that purchased very nice houses in Belgravia and Holland Park and South Kensington. And it has been established that this Greek influx, as a result of capital fleeing the sinking country, had an appreciable effect on house prices in central London. Now, if you conflate wealth and capital, especially at the aggregate level, immediately you should take this as an increase in capital, in British capital. And you should expect that if capital has gone up, then at some point, to the extent that capital is an input into the production of income, that GDP in Britain there would be an uptick. There was no uptick, of course, because there is no productive contribution to any productive process if house prices in Belgravia simply go up. Right? Some people benefit from that, namely those who sell them, but nothing much happens in the process of capital accumulation. This is why we need to make the distinction if we're going to understand how capitalism works. Piketty doesn't want it. Now, his argument is that wealth begets wealth, and wealth inequality matters because it gives inordinate social power to those who have the wealth. And he's completely right on this. Now, the interesting question is, from a meta-narrative kind of perspective, why didn't he try to emulate Adam Smith? Adam Smith, after all, made his name, not through the theory of moral sentiments, which I quoted before, but from a book called, which we know as, The Wealth of Nations. So Mr. Piketty, who is a very ambitious young French professor, could have written The New Wealth of Nations, but he didn't write The New Wealth of Nations. His book borrows the title from The Bearded One. He calls it Capital in the 21st Century. Now, there are two reasons why I think this is my interpretation, I may be completely wrong. He chose to emulate Karl Marx, even though his book is completely, basically, fundamentally anti-Marxist. The reason, however, he tried to become the Marx of the 21st century, to write Das Kapital for the 21st century, I think was twofold. Firstly, he understood, he's a very clever man, Piketty, right, and quite well-read. He understood that Adam Smith was a trickle-down person. You heard the quotation. So he couldn't aspire to becoming the Adam Smith of the 21st century with the message that he had to convey. Secondly, Smith has no theory of income or wealth distribution. Why does he have no theory of income or wealth distribution? Because he was intellectually honest. He understood that it is impossible, and that's the subject of another talk, but let me just provide it to you as a statement, as a hypothesis, which actually we have, with another two people, we have dedicated a whole book to that, with Nicholas Theocharakis and Joseph Halevi. The contention I'm making is that it is impossible, not difficult, big difference, it is impossible to have simultaneously a coherent theory of value of why is this worth $1 and this is worth $700, and a theory of progress, of growth, of wealth creation. That is to have a static theory which tells you that this is worth twice as much as that, and a theory which tells you how surplus is created through time. And having grasped that, that's at least my interpretation, Smith decided to do one or not the other. To have a theory which does not try to explain the relative value of a tractor and a worker. So how does he get away with this? He assumes that the income distribution doesn't change through time. So it's like saying, I can't explain it, I will take it for granted. Now that would not be something that Piketty would like to emulate, because he wants to tell a story about how inequality evolves through time. So Smith is out for him. And also, yeah, he's French. He may not be a Marxist, but he understands the narrative discursive power of Marx's epic story of contradiction, confrontation, and evolution, and revolution. And he wants to embed himself in this tradition of epic storytelling, as opposed to the cold Scotsman from Glasgow, who is giving you a very honest, but limited in terms of its a revolutionary context capacity, oeuvre, narrative. Now, let me, without further ado, tell you what I think the basis of his theory is. As an economist, and as somebody who wants to emulate Marx without being Marxist, he understands the importance of combining a very closed theoretical model, a very tight theoretical analysis, explanation of why inequality is going crazy, with an empirical part in which he shows that, okay, this is what the theory says, and look at the evidence. The evidence conforms with the theory before he gives us his own view as to what should be done. Okay, so let's focus on the one thing that makes his book interesting and successful, at least from the perspective of Paul Krugman or Joe Stiglitz, which is the theory, the economic theory. Piketty's book would never have cut the masters if there was no theoretical proof that could be explained by means of two or three simple equations, that inequality is a natural tendency for capitalism without having a Marxist perspective on capitalism. So, having read it painfully and against my wishes, all 700 and something pages of it, my view is that there are three basic laws that Mr. Piketty is propounding. And I've written them on the board there. The first law is a tautology, which is always nice to have because it's by definition correct. It's like saying 5 equals 5. So the tautology that I'm referring to is that the wealth share of GDP, if you want the ratio, if you have a ratio, you, on the numerator you put wealth, total wealth, and then the denominator you have national income, is a ratio of the wealth income share of GDP. So that is, if you want, for each dollar of national income, what is the value of wealth? What is the value that wealth produces during that year, wealth income in that country, divided by wealth income per dollar of wealth, per unit of wealth. Now, it can be, I won't bother you with this, but it can be shown that this is nothing but a tautology. But he uses it later on. Okay, he calls this a law. Whether 5 equals 5 is a law, I'm not sure. But nevertheless, the second law is a hypothesis. It is a genuine hypothesis, not a tautology. It can be either right or wrong. And it is that the wealth share of GDP rises when the growth rate of national income is less than the ratio of savings over total wealth. So, what is the growth rate of the United States economy at the moment? 2.5%? 2.5%, 3%? So, if savings in this country as a ratio of total wealth is more than 3%, then his theory, the second law, tells us, if it can be proven, that wealth inequality is going to get worse. In the sense that the share of national income that goes
savings,
to...
savings, though, and you have unavoided savings over wealth.
Yeah.
So how can you explain why you changed that? I don't understand it. You said savings just now.
Yeah, I did.
If savings is greater than 3%.
No, savings over as a proportion of total wealth.
Okay, but you if said that, savings alone.
I didn't. I have recorded it.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I said savings as a proportion of total wealth. If that is greater than the growth rate, okay, then wealth share of GDP will be increasing. And that's a hypothesis. And he needs several axioms or assumptions in order to support that hypothesis, and I shall refer to them in a minute. Okay, the third law is, I think, quite uncontroversial. He simply argues that through the system of inheritance, if you have this kind of wealth multiplication, right, then there is a tendency for that wealth multiplication to accelerate, simply because the wealthy leave a lot of wealth to their kids, and that accelerates the dynamics of wealth inequality. I think that most of us would have no problem accepting that.
Excuse me.
Yes.
S over W again. He actually uses the interest rate or rate of return on capital. Why are you not using S over W rather than the interest rate?
You're jumping ahead. You're jumping ahead. What I'm saying is that this is a basic law. When we're in a minute, I will explain under what conditions will. No, it's okay. That's fine. All I'm saying is that this is what he needs in order to make his thesis stick regarding increasing wealth inequality. And what you are referring to is the axioms that he needs to impose regarding the rate of return to capital and the rate of return to wealth in order to make this stick. So I'm coming to this in a minute. So let me, before I get to this point, however, just summarize as briefly as I can what I think the gist of his argument is. The gist of his argument is that we live in a low-growth world, which is true, especially after 2008. Larry Summers couldn't agree more with his thesis about secular stagnation and so on and so forth. One of the reasons why Larry Summers loved this book. Okay. Secondly, in this low-growth environment, net savings boost the proportion of wealth to national income because the proportion of savings in relation to total wealth rises faster than national income. And then the first law, the tautology, kicks in, because if the ratio of total wealth to GDP rises, then the already wealthy acquire access to a higher rate of return to their wealth in proportion to existing wealth. And then that means that returns to wealth also rise as a proportion of national income, And finally, with the third law, the wealth inequality multiplier becomes a wealth inequality accelerator. Now, let me now go back to the justification, the proof that he offers for the second law, which is the linchpin. Without that, the narrative doesn't stick. Well, the first assumption that has to be accepted, if you want to follow his logic, is that savings translate directly into investments, which build up wealth. Without that assumption, without the assumption that all savings are an input into the economy through investment, through capital accumulation, as we would say, and that this capital accumulation leads to new wealth, his second law doesn't hold. Now, empirically speaking, this is rubbish. I mean, look at Europe today. We have a huge excess of savings over investment. And none of it is invested. Yes?
But that's why he conflates wealth and capital, right? Because it's true if you're talking about wealth.
No, it's not. If I buy a Picasso, it doesn't breed more wealth.
Oh, so you're agreeing then?
No, hang on a second. Remember what you said?
Investment equals increasing capital. Because if you just separate wealth and capital, you say when people save more, they have more savings, more money.
Can I ask you to leave this until the end? Because, you know, otherwise the discussion is going to end up derailing the talk. The point I'm making is this. I'm going along with what he's suggesting. So he's suggesting, right, that wealth and capital are one and the same thing, and he's arguing that all saved income, whether it comes from wealth or from productive effort, translates into investments, which translates into new wealth. And what I'm saying is that, empirically speaking, this is insupportable. It cannot be supported, empirically speaking. But it has to be accepted in order to support his second law. His response was, you're right, in the short run, it's not true that all savings translate into capital accumulation, but in the long term, it does. Well, one is tempted to refer back to John Maynard Keynes, who said, in the long run, we're all dead. But I shan't do that. What I'm saying, I will point out that the empirical part of his work, what is he telling us empirically, for those of you who've read the book? He's telling us that after the 1970s, there was a reversal of a phenomenon that went on for a very long while during the 20th century. And inequality has been getting much worse, whereas it was getting better between the First World War, the Great War, and the end of Bretton Woods. Okay? So what I'm saying is that if the last 4 decades were enough in order to establish that was sufficiently long term for him to be able to claim that he's established a regularity, then it must be long enough to establish that he's wrong about this hypothesis, because over the last four decades, savings has not translated into investment. The last four decades, we've had consistent excess savings, excess over investment. Okay. So let me now move on to another assumption that he needs to make in order to support the second law, which is the linchpin of his argument. He has to argue that capital prices, the price of capital, or the rate of return to capital, and the rate of return to labor, can be determined by the productivity of the last machine used, of the last hour worked. It is the only way he can make this point. In other words, he needs to slide back into vulgar neoclassical economics. And on top of that, he needs to impose a very particular relationship between output, capital, and labor. A very particular, even within neoclassical economics, without which his system doesn't work. In technical terms, he needs to introduce a constant elasticity of substitution production function with elasticity greater than 1. Okay. He says, okay, the facts in this world of ours are not inconsistent with this assumption. That's what his argument is in the book. They're not inconsistent with this assumption. but they're not inconsistent with the assumption that pigs fly when we're not observing them either. Okay. Now, the problem that we of the left-wing tradition within economics immediately recognize with this assumption of his, not only with a particular production function, but with the assumption that the rate of return to capital, which he needs to assume a particular form of it in order to support his second law, is logically incoherent. We've always known that. We've known this at least until since the 1950s with the so-called capital controversies. And what is the point? The point is, remember, he needs to assume that the way to understand the return to capital, the price of capital, profit rates, if you want, or surplus value extraction rates, however you want to conceptualize it, okay, that is the physical produce of the last machine used. Okay? But at the aggregate level of the economy, which is how he works at the aggregate level of global capitalism, if you want, right? Not just for national economies, the problem, the logical incongruity involved here is that it is impossible to count capital without having a price for it. So what he's arguing, like all neoclassicists do, is that in order to understand the price of capital, the return to capital, we have to measure it. But then we can show, beyond reasonable doubt, that the only way of measuring it is you have a price for it. Unless we live in a single commodity world, where there is only one commodity, corn, which is both a consumption good, wheat, and a production good or investment good, we plow back into the land to get more corn. Unless you live in that kind of world, his conception of the rate of return to capital is incoherent. Something that even Paul Samuelson, after 10 years of struggling, had to admit, and Robert Solow, standard bearers of the neoclassical economic community. In brief, and this is my message to well-meaning readers, I want to warn them that in buying his narrative, they are buying into the following. Firstly, the impossibility of involuntary unemployment. Because if you adopt his neoclassical mantra, there can be no involuntary unemployment to the extent that labor is paid a price given by its marginal productivity. Like potatoes, there is a simple way of selling them, and that is by reducing their price until they clear. Similarly with labor. If you have no concept of the difference between potatoes and labor, like he doesn't, then you end up with the impossibility of unemployment. Secondly, unqualified adoption of supply-side economics. Because in his world, if savings always translate into investment, then there is absolutely no reason why Say's law doesn't hold. In other words, the idea that supply creates its own demand, and therefore the only thing you need to care about is the supply side of the economy by reducing costs, making labor more elastic, and so on and so forth. Thirdly, there is no such thing as bargaining between capital and labor. That the labor process is exactly the same as when I swap an apple of mine with a banana of yours. Fourthly, there are no macroeconomic effects on the wage in his model. So, for instance, wages and the equilibrium wage in the labor market does not depend on unemployment. Firstly, there's no theory of unemployment, but even if there was, let's say for some reason there was unemployment inexplicably for the theory, there can be no concept of a downward pressure on wages because workers are fearing unemployment more because unemployment is higher. That is not possible to incorporate into his analysis. In a sense, his economics, his economic model is a supply-side Chicago model without a trickle-down effect. It's Chicago with a trickle-up effect. That is what it is. And I'm going to answer the question that I started the talk with. Why has it been so successful? And I think that there are three answers that I want to give at this stage. Firstly, professional economists, those ensconced in the ivory towers of neoclassicism, love to present themselves as non-dogmatic. They love to have neoclassicists amongst themselves coming up with lefty views to show that neoclassical economics is scientific and it doesn't take sides on the left-right debate. And Piketty gives them an excellent opportunity to do this. So you see, for the economics profession, they want to be non-dogmatic as long as they're penchant for a dogmatic acceptance of a model which is infinitely removed from really existing capitalism is dogmatically unchallenged. Secondly, a certain degree of expediency on behalf of Mr. Piketty. Remember, his book has been portrayed as the best thing since sliced bread by the media, by journalists. Generalists love simple stories. And they love simple numbers. With these three equations here, it was possible for Mr. Piketty to argue that if the wealth income to total wealth ratio is around 5%, then if you plug this number in there, you can show that there is a steady state. Wealth over GDP tends to be six times. So wealth tends to be six times larger than GDP. So wealth overwhelms society, it undermines liberal democracy and so forth. Okay? So these numbers, 5% leads to six times of, to wealth being six times the level of national income, sounds like something a Wall Street journalist, Wall Street Journal journalist, a Financial Times journalist would be able to write 700 words out of very, very quickly. And it's no great mystery, therefore, that Piketty's book won the Financial Times Best Book of the Year. I want to finish by bringing this back into something that is connected to science and society. Because this title, Against Equality, comes from an article that I published in Science and Society. When was it? 2004, something like that. In which I was telling a similar story, but not about Piketty, he wasn't around at the time. But the story I was trying to tell, again, was a cautionary tale against establishment figures that were putting forward egalitarian tales. The point I was trying to raise was that if you look at the 1970s, early 1970s, the debate between John Rawls and Robert Nozick, for instance, what do you see? You see a splendid social democratic figure who wrote a book, The Theory of Justice, John Rawls, which today is considered to be a left-wing treatise. Of course, John Rawls was aiming it against the Marxist left in order to propose that there is something, you know, to propose to radical students at Harvard and MIT and so on, that they should be joining him in the search for what I call, he didn't call it that, but that's what he meant, the optimal degree of inequality. A degree of inequality which is just enough in order to make the worst off as well off as they can, but not so much that it underpins, it throws a spanner in the works of the free market system. And what happened? 3 years later, Robert Nozick came out with an audacious book called Anarchy, State, and Utopia, and in my estimation, blasted John Rawls out of the water. Why? He asked a simple question. Mr. Rawls, let's say we agree with you, and the ODI, the optimal degree of inequality, is to be discovered in the way that you're suggesting, behind the veil of ignorance, with all of us going through this mental experiment, how much inequality would we want to live under, that kind of thing. Right? Let's say we agree on that, and let's say create an income distribution which is precisely that ODI, the optimal degree of inequality, right? And then one of us develops wonderful basketballing skills, and the rest want to watch, to pay him money to play more and more to enjoy him. What are you proposing, Professor Rawls? Are you proposing, A, that we should ban that, because that would upset the optimal degree of inequality, since it would create more inequality? So would you ban consenting adults from doing good capitalist things amongst themselves, in which case you are illiberal? Or would you allow for this to go on, in which case your ODI is not the ODI, because you are allowing for deviations from what your scheme tells you or us is the optimal degree of inequality? And Nozick's point, which was a very radically progressive point, which of course led to a misanthropic conclusion, but his progressive radical point was that it's the process, stupid. It is the process that determines whether society is free and just. If what we do with one another, and that's a process, the way we work with one another, the way we relate one another, the way we collaborate with another, if these relationships are good and proper and just, then who gives a damn about the outcome? You cannot impose an end state solution without violating basic principles, both of liberty and of justice. And you know what? This was Marx's point. Marx's point. Marx's point was that capitalism is not bad because it produces inequality, that it's immoral. Marx's point was that capitalism is basically, fundamentally, profoundly illiberal because the process of producing stuff is exploitative and highly inefficient. And we end up all being servants of capital goods that were supposed to be our servants. And in the end, we become alienated from ourselves and from artifacts. Now, the libertarians don't go that far, but they start from the correct critique of establishment, static, liberal proponents of some kind of bourgeois equality. And my talk is against this kind of equality. And let me just finish it by putting it in very simplistic terms, if you allow me for a second, to move into suburbia. This whole debate reminds me of suburban parents. Suburban parents. You know, the story, I mean, my daughter lives in a suburb in Sydney, and, you know, they have these athletic championships, primary school, you know, year five, year six, and all the kids win a gold medal. Because, you know, you don't want to hurt their feelings, and, you know, they should all treat it equally. And I just freak out when I see this. I mean, either you run or you don't run. And there's nothing wrong with winning the gold medal or, you know, the first prize if you come first. And the argument that, well, if you come first, if you come last, then you're psychologically bruised, and the next time around you don't train as much. That could be so. But I find this extremely boring. And I find it toxic as a parable for capitalist society. Because this is the parable inside Piketty, inside John Rawls. That some of the kids finish first, they have an advantage then, or their kids then get to train harder. It is the race of life at the center, the metaphorical center of their narrative. I would prefer a different one, where the ones who have capital goods are the ones who manage to force, on the basis of a power play, the kids of those who don't have capital goods to hold them on their shoulders and run with them, just like British explorers managed to get up onto Mount Everest with Sherpas carrying including the kitchen sink. And it's a question of the narratives that we use and the mathematical analysis and a penchant for throwing critical light upon narratives and theories like Professor Piketty's, whose purpose is not what is stated, but it is precisely the opposite in the final analysis. Thank you.